Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today I'm talking with Tony Daniel. Tony Daniel's an author of the acclaimed novel Metaplanetary, as well as movie work, radio work, and theater work, and we'll talk about all of that shortly. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
And I just finished Metaplanetary recently and found it a fascinating transhuman or posthuman novel of speculation or imagination. I know you're not trying to predict the future, but you have on your website a description of some of the process that led to your thinking about this very complex and fairly novel set of features of a future human world. And I wondered if you could just recapitulate how it came about that you started to think about these things.
Well, this is I've been writing science fiction for about 15 years now. So, and what's been fascinating me in the last 10 years or so is this is the nanotechnology and the idea that the world could just be transformed quite completely by this idea. And that's sort of the idea phase of it. But I was also out in a park one day, and I was looking up at the sky and just looking at the clouds, and I suddenly thought that's probably how spaceships are going to look in the future, or at least my idea of what spaceships should be. That would be, cloud shapes, nothing definite, something that's sort of amorphous, and especially if something was created in a sort of ecological way rather than all planned out. That's how we'd travel about. So that started it all, and then I got this idea for the Met and all that. That's all part of the book.
The Met is connections between the inner planets of the solar system.
Yeah, it's basically my idea was, well, Brian Aldiss came up with this idea that everyone thought was crazy and could never be, and it illustrated why literary science fiction writers should never write real science fiction of a giant cable connecting the Earth and the Moon, that was spun by some sort of, this is far, far future science fiction tale, spun by these sort of godlike spider creatures. And I always loved that story, and I always thought, the future is going to be something we can't really, we won't be able to predict just from things that we know now. And Aldiss is just as close to being right as anyone is. So I like that idea, and I always thought I'm going to try to justify that this is crazy idea, and I just started going from there, and I thought, well, what if all the planets were connected by these cables? And there is this tether technology they're talking about, and what if they found a way to make the tensile strength strong enough, some new science or something. So I started thinking about that, and eventually I sort of invented a fake science that I had a lot of fun doing this based on some quantum stuff that I barely understand, but that was fun. I'm a science fiction writer. I'm not a scientist. I can say anything I want to. So I created this thing and populated it, and then postulated that there's a big war, and that was my story.
The majority of sentient beings in your future solar system are living in the interstices between the different planets.
Right. Everybody has moved off the planets, and they've moved because these things have so much so much surface. Basically, they're long strings that have beads. It's sort of like a string of pearls with barrels, and these are spinning, and that makes centrifugal force, and so people are living sort of on the inside of these spinning barrels along these strands between the planets in in my conception of things in the inner planets. So in the outer planets, there's these enormous cloud ships that travel between the moons of the gas giants where the people live out there. So, and then the war in the book is a civil war in our solar system between the inhabitants of the inner planets and the outer planets. The inner planets being ruled by a Napoleon-like dictator guy who's trying to, you know, Mr. Control, you know, he's your standard bad guy. But I tried to make him give him some good background to make him see how he came about and such. And the heroes are the outer planet people.
Well, let's flesh out the world a little bit more. You mentioned that you were fascinated by nanotechnology. Your vision of nanotechnology in this book combines elements of quantum computing mm-hmm. with instantaneous quantum telecommunication as well as nanotech. So and it's ubiquitous. All the building materials and everything is suffused with this intelligent substance, and it's also inside our bodies and brains.
Right, and I call that grist.
And grist allows for the ubiquitous telepresence of virtual people who, I guess, you know, as you get into the book, you begin to realize that all of these people had origins as uploaded human personalities.
Right. Well, yeah. Everybody sort of derives from a combination of human personalities that have been built. The converts, as I call them, the free converts are the ones that no longer have a body, avatar of any kind. They're just, you know, they're AIs basically, but they're people, and that's basically the story is that the inner system wants to keep these creatures who are human in every way that I consider something to be a human. They want to keep them in bounds. It's sort of a war of liberation for the converts.
So these virtual people, this dictator Ames,
Amis, yes, that's how I
am. Amis, okay.
Yeah.
He enslaves all of the AIs once he achieves his ascension, and
He's trying to create the big group mind. The idea is that he's going to make the inner system into a big group mind, and he's going to be the head of it, and that's how humanity's going to go to the stars. And the guys in the outer system, they think that you know, there should be a democracy and a plurality of personalities, and as many artificial intelligences as anyone wants to make should be able to exist. And they should all basically have free will, whatever that is.
Now, another feature that you introduce in the book is the idea of large array of personalities. And when I ran across this, I was delighted because I recently wrote an article for the Journal of Evolution and Technology about mm-hmm. the future of brain remediation technology. And one of the things I said was that we would face a crisis in our liberal democratic ideas once we had precisely what you outline here, the large array of personalities, where one personality shared across many bodies. And
right.
So, you know,
they can live different lives.
Yeah, and so they all simultaneously are able to experience one another's lives if they want to.
Yes, because of the grist. The speed of light has been conquered in communication in this future, not in travel. So they can, anywhere they are in the solar system, or basically anywhere in the universe they are, where there's this nanotechnology that incorporates this instantaneous transfer of information, which I go to some lengths to try to explain how that works in the book. They can all have a presence with each other, and it's one big, you know, person that's doing different things all at once. That's you know, parallel processing a bunch of lives.
You say in the book that the people who undergo this LAP transformation have to go through some kind of testing, psychological testing.
Yeah.
Because it would be
schizophrenics should not apply.
Right.
That's my idea.
Right.
And one does, and that's, this is a subplot of the book, one that sort of blows up.
Yeah. You have a kind of, mystical figure who is able to not only be in many places at one time, but also many times at one time.
Right.
Yeah. Thaddeus.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of ideas I threw in there.
Yeah, it's
think about it.
Well, the commentators on the book have all been, as I was, very impressed with the sense of a kind of existential veritas. You know, that you're really there in a radically different world, And I think that's one of the biggest challenges for science fiction. It's incredibly
difficult because you're really working with smoke and mirrors. You know, there's no way I could depict what it would really be like to be a large array of personalities. And so I had to try to sort of suggest it and make you think that you were experiencing it, but of course you weren't, because who the heck could ever write that without being one?
I'm talking today with Tony Daniel. Tony Daniel's the author of Metaplanetary, which is a highly acclaimed novel, science fiction novel. He's been writing science fiction for a long time, and this is his big breakout, I guess. This is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J. Your other novels, you've written a short story collection, Robots, Twilight Companion, Earthling, Warpath. I guess Warpath was, is it Warpath also science fiction? It's set in a Native American...
That was my first book that I wrote in my callow 20s. That was...
Not autobiographical like many, though.
No. No, I wrote that one just out of Clarion West, where I went to a writing workshop out there where I decided I was going to be a science fiction writer at that point. So Warpath is the idea is that Native Americans, specifically the mound-building culture... from down south in America. They disappeared around 1300, and no one really knows exactly why the culture fell, and my postulation was that they discovered a mental trick that allowed them to allow their elites to travel to the stars. And so, you know, basically paddle canoes out there through space via an ability that they discovered, a twisting tesseract kind of thing, whatever. And so Western civilization grows up, goes out there, and finds that all of the nearby planetary systems, star systems near to Earth and the Sun are inhabited by Native Americans. And so there's a new sort of frontier confrontation that recapitulates the old one in certain ways that develops. So I could have done a lot more with that book. It's not my favorite thing I ever wrote, but I still like the idea okay.
It's kind of like that Stargate mentality that the different fragments of Earth history have been scattered across the galaxy.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And then Ascension is your unpublished novel. That's available though in ebook form or
no.
No.
Yeah, that was the...
just in your back pocket there.
Yep. It'll stay there. That's one of those trunk novels. That was the first thing I wrote, and it was. Book about mountain climbing, which I do occasionally. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also come out with a movie that started touring this last year. Is it done? Is it not available to be seen out in the world yet?
No, I'm trying to get it in some festivals. I haven't had any luck so far. But the other portion of my writing has to do with drama and writing various forms of drama. And I started when I moved to New York. I was looking for something besides, I love science fiction, but I wanted to try something else. And so we started a theater group, and I eventually met my wife through this. And now I do a good bit of work in drama, and that led actually to me working for sci-fi.com and seeing your theater.
The theater group was Automatic Vaudeville?
Right, yeah. So we started we started a radio show on New York Public Radio station WBAI, which is ongoing. We've done it over the years now. And we did a live early Saturday morning show with a live band and a group. And it was to do my humorous stuff. And my humorous stuff is sort of Beckett-like, you know, existential stuff that people don't usually laugh at, but I think it's hilarious.
Surrealist radio variety is what you called it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we've done, and those shows are available, archived. You can listen to them at mp3.com. Uh-huh. That was all free, and we did it.
What's your website again?
My website is tonydaniel.com.
Uh-huh. And then the Automatic Vaudeville shows are at?
At automaticvaudeville.com. All one word. You can link to it from there. I have them uploaded for listening. Now, and but that led to the other audio drama work I did at Senior Theater, which is far more professional. And I mean, I love Automatic Vaudeville work, but it's live and it's done in community, at a community. community radio station. The actors are great. And they subsequently were in the movie that we shot.
Oh, so the Automatic Vaudeville folks were the actors in American Bohemian, the
yes.
movie, which
yeah.
is available. Which
they're
you can,
sort of, yeah, you can't really see it right now.
But you can look at the website.
You can look at the website.
AmericanBohemian.com.
Yes, that's
yeah.
right.
And that's about 20-somethings coming of age. And
Yeah, it's not science fiction, although there are some interesting trips in there.
So, well,
not brought about by scientific, but, well, I don't know, brought about by chemical means.
Last week, when we were going to originally do this interview, you got called down to Washington to cover the big anti-war demonstration there. And I was wondering what, you know, just what your travelogue was about that demonstration, what your current thoughts are about the war. And, you know, it seems like there's a very political theme in your work. Last week when we talked about it, you said that it wasn't hard to be for democracy, but actually sometimes it gets pretty tricky to be for democracy, exactly what democracy is.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts about this current conflict?
Oh, I don't know. I'm ambivalent about it. It's very difficult to advocate going to war, as in any case ever. When you have read anything about what wars are like, of course I was never in a war, and I'm thankful for that. But at the same time, you know, it's difficult to condone some of the tyrannical practices that are still exist in our world. So I don't know. But I went down there more because I'm concerned about civil liberties in the U.S. Than I am about whether or not we go to war in Iraq, the United States, that is.
You know, thinking about the controversy about the anti-war movement. I'm a democratic leftist from my background and have always, you know, fought my sectarian turf battles against the Stalinists and the Maoists and everybody else who inhabit that same space when you get to an anti-war demonstration. This one was organized by the Workers' World Party. And
right, yeah. It was organized by a great many of rather extreme leftist groups, but the people who were there were not. This was a cross-section of middle American liberaldom that was there. You know, this was pile jacket wearing soccer moms and you know, patchouli smelling teenagers and whatnot, you know, with your scattered, you know, anarchist syndicalists, you know, wandering about and stern-faced socialists mixed in. But in general, it was, you know, it was pretty much a mainline event, which really surprised me. There's a lot of people there.
In your novel, Metaplanetary, you have a revolutionary guerrilla activist named Jill, who's a former rat-catching ferret who gets an intelligence enhancement and a new human body, and then hooks up with a bunch of rats who have been inhabited by or melded with rogue viral AI.
Right.
And I thought that was a pretty interesting political you know, it's like the lumpen, the organization of the lumpen proletarian in AI terms or something.
Yeah, in a way. Or just the, you know, the idea that that you're not going to get a regulated society no matter what you try to do, that the very security programs you use will sometimes escape. And that's what happened. There were basically, the book starts out before the war, set in this place. That's the dump of the solar system. It's the garbage heap of the solar system called the carbuncle. And all these escaped security algorithms and little pieces of code that aren't quite sentient, but they're pretty close, go there. And they sort of hide out in rats and other vermin, because that's sort of what they resemble mentally to themselves. They feel at home there. So and this is what Jill has done, and she's incorporated into a ferret. And the humans there hunt some of these codes.
So
and it's a physical hunt also of ferrets and rats.
Mm-hmm. So,
and this happens actually in England, and I read about this. This is where the idea came from. There's some guys that take out, you know, combinations of rat terrier dogs and ferrets and go rat hunting for a weekend, which is fascinating to me. I really want to see that someday. But it happens. It's like a hobby, you know.
Metaplanetary is the first of a trilogy?
Yeah, it looks like it. It's at least the first of a couple of books, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've written the second one.
When's it going to come out?
I'm working on the. It'll come out next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on the revision now with my editor at Harper.
Great. Well, I'm sure we're all eagerly anticipating it. That was one of the biggest complaints of the reviewers was that they had to wait for the sequels.
I couldn't get it all into one book. I hate trilogies, but, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. Well, our expectations are whetted. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I very much appreciate the opportunity.
And you can read more of Tony Daniel's work at tonydaniel.com. For the next couple minutes, we'll listen to some audio in memory of the astronauts of the Space Shuttle Columbia, who died today on reentry. Commander Rick Husband, Pilot Willie McCool, Mission Specialists Kalpana Chawla, Laurel Clark, Mike Anderson, David Brown, and Israeli Payload Specialist Ilan Ramon.
The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, at 7:30 their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside. So as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, the propellers sliding into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived has turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews have rushed to their posts and spots, and orders are being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty, mighty proud of the place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt busting with activity, as we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it... just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring mast. And all the folks between that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's flames. 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers speeding around here. I can't even talk to people. There's friends around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside where I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others do.
back right. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Mode control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off.
We're home.
413 is in.
Man on the moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff of the 25th space shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Roger, roll, Challenger. Good roll program confirmed. Challenger now heading downrange. Engines beginning throttling down now at 94%. Normal throttles for most of the flight, 104%. We'll throttle down to 65% shortly. Engines at 65%, three engines running normally, three good fuel cells, three good APUs. Velocity, 2,257 feet per second. Altitude, 4.3 nautical miles. Downrange distance, 3 nautical miles. Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.